In this week's episode of Higher Learning, we talked to Kevin Salinas, the VP of Finance at Lumen Technologies. Kevin has managed to stay and grow at one company over 20 years and three acquisitions. He has an incredible story to tell and such great philosophies on everything from leadership to hiring to best financial practices. I love this conversation and I know you're going to love it too. I can't wait for you to hear it.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. Today, we have a very special guest. We are joined by Kevin Salinas. He's the Vice President of Finance with Lumen Technologies. How are you doing today, Kevin?
Doing well. Great. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great, bud. You are out in the Denver area, right?
Yeah, just west of Denver in the suburbs.
Have you been there your whole life, or is that a place you moved? Or I know a lot of people migrate west towards Denver.
Yeah, I'm one of the few. My wife and I are one of the few natives that are in Colorado. I haven't lived here our whole lives, but we were born and raised here, moved away to New York for about 9 years or so, and then moved back. So it pulled us back and will probably keep us here forever at this point. So
I tell people all the time, because I come from the West Coast myself, the most outdoorsy people, the best outdoors place to live. You know, if you like hiking, if you like running, if you like biking, skiing, whatever it is, Colorado's got a ton of it. I got to ask you though, with such a confluence of people figuring that out and migrating into your city, has that been a bad or good thing, or are there pros and cons like with everything?
Probably pros and cons. I think, I don't know, it certainly creates more amenities. Trails are a little more crowded and things like that. But overall, I think people just figure out it's an easy place to live. It's
for sure.
The weather is far better, I think, than people think it is.
That's something I want to point out, actually. I don't think people understand. I think I heard that there's like 300 days of sunshine in Denver. And so even though it gets a little bit cold, there's always that sunshine, which is very different than, say, Seattle, where it's overcast 300 days a year, or up in the Midwest or in the Northeast. So I think that's something. Now, listen, now I'm hurting you, because anybody listening to this podcast might be looking up Zillow right now and checking out moving to Denver. But that's an underrated part of it. The weather is really, really good out there.
Absolutely.
Love it. So I want to talk about, I'm always fascinated by how people get into the careers they do. So I'm interested, what drew you into finance? Is that something where, you know, you were playing Monopoly as a kid and you were always the banker? Is that something you were drawn to at a young age? Or is that something that more happened over time?
No, I think I always kind of gravitated towards the money stuff. It always just kind of made intuitive sense to me. But really, growing up and through high school and through college, I thought I wanted to go into computer science, and then I really wasn't the greatest coder. So I kind of went the CIS route of like IT and system administration and those sorts of things. And it didn't take very long in working in that field to realize I was seeing like very small pictures all the time. And anytime I'd be involved in a big picture thing, I'd get really excited about it and I'd have a lot more energy, and kind of realized that staying in that IT world for me wasn't exactly where I wanted to be. Took too long for me to realize all of that. But then I think I did a lot of soul searching and realized that it was really, you know, all along of kind of finance, the way I think, all of that. So went back to school, got a finance degree, and started the finance path. And here I am kind of 20 years later on that. So.
Well, there's a little bit of similarity in my path as well. I actually did not go to school for technology. I didn't think that that's where I wanted to be, but ended up taking my first job in information technology and actually ascended into a project manager role. But then I actually ended up falling into the HR space. And then lo and behold, now we build software. We do so much work on the technology side that I've been kind of able to marry all those things together. So, you know, your career journey usually is not a linear path. It's usually one that goes, you know, all over the place. And so I can certainly empathize with that. You are the VP of Finance at Lumen, and we talked about that. And you've been at the company for a while, and the company's evolved many times since you started over 20 years ago. So the first thing I want to point out is that longevity is incredible. That's not something you see every day today. And then I'm really interested on what you might attribute to your ability to be in an environment that went through multiple acquisitions like that, and how you, I don't want to say survive, but how have you thrived in that type of change, and because that can be very disruptive, right?
Yeah, it's definitely disruptive. I think that the biggest thing that I would probably say that it comes down to is being flexible and adaptable. The first 10 years or so I was with Time Warner, incredible company, great culture, smaller company, very comfortable though in what I was doing, and we didn't really acquire a whole lot. We acquired one company the entire 10 years. Not a lot of change. So I got very comfortable. That was a very rude awakening when I got into the next company when Level 3 acquired us, and kind of quickly realized that I have to be flexible, I have to be adaptable, and really just do what the business is asking me to do and look at everything as a new experience, a learning opportunity, new ways of doing things, and a willingness to kind of throw out the old way of doing things to find the best way. And kind of looking at everything as a new experience was a big way for me to be flexible and adaptable and kind of keep things going. And at being three different companies, while I never had a different W-2 necessarily, and I never really interviewed for a new job, it was essentially working at three completely different companies. So, there was a lot of new things, a lot of experiences, a lot of things to learn there.
You got the best of both worlds. You never actually never had to leave the company, but you got to, be in different environments and different cultures and experience new things. Did you play kind of a central role in the integration of, financial systems and finance for all of those acquisitions? Or is that part of the reason why you think that there's been such great longevity because they saw you as such an asset in terms of helping integrate the financials of both companies?
I was a small part, I would say, in some of the integration, but it was more probably not even the financial systems, probably more from like a process perspective, team, integration, those sorts of things. Only till like recently, I'd say at Lumen, with some of the divestitures that we're actually doing, kind of spinning off pieces of the business, have I been a little bit more involved in that side of it. But certainly a part of kind of the inner workings of how the teams and processes and things like that have come together.
Okay, that makes sense to me. So I'm interested, 20 years later, what has stayed the same and what has demonstrably changed in the company over these the course of these different acquisitions?
Yeah, I think from staying the same, it's because it's still telecom, different companies, different sizes, but I think the competitive landscape is roughly the same. The names kind of change, but the big players don't change, and the main competitors are still there. And so you're still trying to put out the best products in a constantly evolving technology world. So nothing really changes, I think, there. I think the big changes really was the size of the company and what kind of comes with that. And Time Warner was about when by the time we got acquired, it was about 3,000. I think it started around 1,800 when I started there. And Level 3 went to 13,000 employees, and then Lumen has about 25,000. And the way that things are managed in a company going from 3,000 all the way to 25 are very different. The decisions that you make are so have such a ripple effect in so many other pieces of the business that the concept of scale has to really come into that. And you have to, I think, in the 25,000 person side of the really large company, you have to pay really close attention to not creating silos, because they create very, very simply. It's very easy to just work in your individual area, create your things without any regard of anybody else. And they kind of just pop up naturally. And you spend a lot of time, I think, trying to break those down and fight against those and to be productive.
Yeah. One of the things that I see with successful integrations that is really the key, in my opinion, I'm a little bit biased here, but like obviously you got to be able to consolidate systems, you got to be able to consolidate processes and bring things together. But really what it comes down to is that the people aspect is really key, right? The change management, the bringing one company into another, trying to get those cultures to assimilate, trying to get, people to learn new things when they've been doing something for a certain way for so long can really make or break an integration, or at the very least, draw it out longer than it should and make it more tumultuous than it should. So I just think that's a really key aspect. Do you feel like, the different organizations put a focus on the people side of it and then that's why there was ultimately success? Or what did you see there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was definitely a large culture shift with all three companies. They were all just different, no better or worse probably, but just very different. But that is the key. It's really the people side of it and how you integrate it. And the thing I would constantly tell myself, because all of these acquisitions and integrations are just so chaotic, and everybody inevitably is trying to kind of jockey for their own position or the process they put in place or the things that they're doing, because there's a certain amount of security with that. The only thing I can control is how I lead my team and what they see. And if I can somehow shield them even a bit from the chaos and things and keep a steady force. They stick around and they actually feel rewarded, and we actually progress in getting things integrated.
Yeah, and listen, that as much as I say it's the people first aspect, it's really the leaders and the managers that make or break these types of things. And being able to shield your team and help them understand the new way forward when things are a little bit chaotic and tumultuous like that, I think is really key. I know that leadership's really important to you. I'm interested, and I ask this of a lot of leaders, what do you see as the difference between effective leadership and effective management? Do you see that there's a difference between the two?
I would definitely see a difference. Management to me is more, I kind of think more supervisory. I need to get these tasks done. I need to make sure, things are getting completed. Kind of more of a tactical approach. I think leadership is more vision. It's about finding ways to get your team successful. It's about growing other leaders more than probably anything, and helping people become successful. And I think ultimately the manager, while focused on the tactical, I think the leader would be focused more on the cultural aspect. Like, what culture do you want in your team? Regardless of whatever the company culture is, how can you create a culture within your team where people, have that predictable experience of what they know they're coming into every day?
Yeah, I love that. Another thing that I would delineate there is that I think that you can have leaders who aren't managers. In fact, I see it all throughout my company. I see it all everything in everyday life. But it's very hard to be a good to great manager without being a good to great leader. Like a lot of the things that make you a great leader are the things that are much, very much necessary and prerequisites to be a good manager. And to your point, being a manager is about kind of getting the most out of a group of people and taking them to places that they haven't been before. Being a great leader, though, I feel like a lot of that is tied to, I always say that it's 90% what you do and 10% what you say. Because if it's 90, if you're doing 90% of the right things, then that moment when you speak up is really going to resonate with the people, right? Because if one of the things that can really undermine your credibility is if you're saying things that are important, but you're not living those out, you're not a good leader if you're not doing that. Saying that, though, a manager a lot of times is not doing individual contribution like the people on their team. And so them having to be an amazing coder, right, to lead a team of coders doesn't make you a less effective manager if you have other skills that you can bring to the table. Sometimes it helps, but I've seen it many times not have to be the case. And so I think a lot of times that can be the difference. But I totally agree with kind of what you said too. And I think it's very spot on. Do you have, like, it sounds like leadership is something that's really important. It sounds like you've done an effective job of growing the next leaders in your company. It sounds to me like you're hiring people not with the concern like, oh, this person's really talented, or what's your approach when you're evaluating people for your team? Are you looking for people that are smarter, have more potential than yourself, or are you looking at it and saying, I want to kind of pick and choose and make sure I have the right people in the right spots?
Yeah, I definitely want people that are smarter and more talented than me. I think one of the things that I've found is if folks are really good at doing the job that itself, they probably should be leading a different team, because it's very easy if I know how to do like every aspect of that job and you're just not totally getting it right, I can just step in and do it. And that creates a problem in that I'm only one person. And it creates a problem in that I'm not helping to coach or grow or anything, and nobody's really learning anything there. So I want to bring people in that can do things that I can't, because they can just make the team that much better. And
Love that. Very profound. I actually have not heard that before, and it makes a ton of sense because you're right. If you are an expert in the space that you're leading, there's some pros to that. But I also think that your nature, a lot of the time, is to step in and fix things and have the answer. And your team, you stunt your team's growth when you do that. You stunt your ability to scale when you do that. And who knows that better than you, going from an organization of 3,000 to 25,000, the impact that can have in terms of the company being able to continue to grow and gain more market share. So we talk a little bit about leaders. Is there any leaders throughout your career that stand out to you, maybe that inspired you to be the leader you are?
Oh yeah. I've been pretty lucky over the last 20 plus years to work with a lot of really good leaders, but there's definitely one that sticks out. I worked with, I don't know, probably 5, 6 years ago for a number of years, and she led our entire sales group. She was our sales president, and at the time I was supporting the revenue side of the business, and so it was kind of dotted line over to her. And what stuck out to me, one, we had a great working relationship, and I felt like she trusted and actually wanted my opinions and perspective and all of that. But what I could also see, even though I didn't directly report to her, I could see the way that she pushed me and always like motivated me, but pushed me to be the best I could in like the most loving of ways. I think that's what I really aspire to be, because I saw that I mean, people would run through walls to do everything they could to be successful in that sales team. And some of that was because of her. And I know, like, just the way I felt wanting to be like the absolute best I could and perform at an absolute level, to make sure she was successful. And that's an art, I think, to just kind of pushing without demeaning or pushing people down,
I love that. I love that. And you're absolutely right about that. I have something in my office, and it's the five tenets of effective leadership. And it says something along the lines of use your title and authority rarely, if at all. And really, what that means is, and she didn't have that direct line authority, and yet that didn't matter. You didn't want to disappoint, you wanted to run through a wall. The team wanted to do that. And that's what true management and leadership is. A lot of times having the need to say, I have this person in terms of their performance review, or I have the ability to hire or fire them, or whatever it is, that can only get you so far. The ability to inspire and really drive the best work out of people, that's what is sustainable. That's what builds great culture. And that's what great leaders are all about. Have you seen that you've taken some of the tools out of that tool belt and tried to apply them to your own leadership since you've worked with her?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely still work on that balance of trying to motivate and push people to be what I see in them. And always try to kind of mind that line, I would say, of not like pushing too hard, which is tough sometimes when there's a lot of really hard deliverables in there. But ultimately I try to think of the team first and the person that's kind of behind that. And that's something that she always modeled. And it's very easy to lose sight of, I think, as times just get kind of crazy and there's always something going on. And that's probably the number one thing of just try to think of the person that's behind the task before anything else.
I love that. When was the last time you let her know you felt this way, or have you ever let her know you felt this way about her leadership?
I don't know. Probably hasn't been all that long. She knows I miss her.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, listen, here's the thing.
For
I would
sure.
tell you that as somebody that takes a great pride in leadership and management, the best compliment I can get is if somebody says, when I worked for you or when I worked under you, I did my best work. I don't know if I would have been able to achieve it without it. And as much as you feel like that type of validation is maybe unnecessary for somebody who's accomplished and successful, that's the type of thing that fuels me and gives me juice. So if you haven't told her that, let her know that. That is probably the best compliment you can give her. And that's what you really want to know. That's what you really care about as a manager or leader, is that you're having an impact, because there's so many things you're doing on the back end that go unseen, that sometimes you wonder, man, am I getting through? Am I really making it happen? So I would highly recommend that if she doesn't know that, maybe this would be a good opportunity to reach out to her and let her know.
Absolutely.
All right, this is a hiring podcast, so we got to talk about that. I know you've done a lot of hiring in your time, and like I said, you've been in multiple environments, and so maybe the way that you've hired and what you were assessing has changed as the company has changed. So I'm interested to get into that. Let's start here. Do you have a overall hiring philosophy, one that like, I'm not going to hire, or I am going to only hire people like XYZ into my team?
I think that the thing that I really would focus on, I guess, there, I want to see that people are drivers of action and drivers of change. Those are the big things that I want to see, because those are things that you can't really teach. The skills, the hard skills, things like that, that's all teachable. But what I'm really looking for is, does someone have the initiative to go and do things themselves? Can they navigate change, and will they push for it? And I think, especially now, the world just keeps moving faster and faster. And the biggest thing is, are we from a finance perspective helping to drive the change in the business, or are we just reading the news? And it's pretty easy to just read the news. It's a lot more difficult to find someone who can really drive that change and kind of be a change agent for the company and honestly point out where things aren't going very well and maybe people think they're going great.
Listen, I think my CFO. That's one of the biggest things I say about him. I've had people I've worked with in the past in finance that read the news. He's somebody that is in the business and is leveraging finance to transform and drive the business. And I think That kind of strategic understanding and action and execution-oriented mindset is key for any role, let alone from a perspective in finance. I'm interested though, how in an interview process are you trying to determine that? Like, do you have favorite questions you like to ask to determine that, or how do you kind of get to that?
Yeah, I'd say one of the main things, and I'll kind of just branch off from this, but is tell me about a time when you proactively researched something and drove a change. And I'm kind of looking for a couple of different things there. One, the proactive piece, I want to understand like their initiative, like somebody doesn't have to come to them constantly and say, hey, I noticed this, can you go look it up? But it's did they find something? And then also if it's proactive, somebody's not asking for it, so they're going to have to sell that, and they're going to have to work through and deal with the stakeholders and the possible pushback and the politics of it. And did they get it through? And it might be something small, and an analyst may not have some really huge opportunity to make some giant change, but that doesn't really matter. It's did you get the change through? What happened? How did that process go? And that I think says a lot of, are you actually trying to drive something? Did you find something on your own? And I think it kind of ends up steering the entire conversation, really.
Yeah, I imagine you get some really compelling answers from that too. Maybe
Yeah.
sometimes you don't either. That's kind of an idea of whether you want to work with
No,
that person or
it's
not.
definitely telling of like, okay, yeah, definitely a more tactical person probably isn't going to be the right fit. So.
I love that. Great stuff. What about a memorable interview experience? If I asked you about that, what comes to mind? Maybe one you were interviewing for, or you were interviewing somebody. Any come to mind?
Yeah, there's an interesting one. As me as an interviewer, and this was really just after I finished my finance degree. And I will say now, like comparing myself 20 years ago to the graduates that are coming out of school now is like wildly different. Like they're
Night
so
and
much
day.
more prepared and ready. And I did not prepare well for this interview. I knew about the company. I knew somebody that worked there, but I didn't prepare enough. I kind of went in really cold. And on the same side, they didn't really prepare by looking through my resume and realizing I just had started, just this was my first job with, at least with a finance degree. And so they were peppering me with all of these very like larger business behavioral questions. And I didn't have much experience with that either. So I was just bombing it. And it was bad because I was just kind of waiting for this thing to end essentially. But walking out, it was clear like I definitely didn't get that job. But I was also kind of clear on like maybe I didn't want this either. Like it was a manufacturing company that seemed a bit old-fashioned with how they did things. I much more gravitate towards like a technology sort of space. And then if they're not going to spend any time and read my resume or understand any of that, like, is this really the people culture type of thing that I want too? So, while I completely bombed it, it was probably for the best that it turned out that way. And it taught me a big lesson of be prepared when you go into these things, understand what you're going in for, and it taught me a lot. And luckily it was early enough in the career to course
I really love
correct.
that. There's a couple of things that stand out to me there. Now, listen, I got to say that the proliferation of the internet has made it easier to prepare in these situations for
For
sure. Because
sure, yeah.
I graduated high school in 99. I graduated from college in 2004. I didn't have access to any of these things when it came to dating, cooking recipes, interview prep. I mean, the internet has been an amazing thing from a lot of perspectives. However, Zoomers do not get a lot of love in terms of like great publicity for being prepared and being more ready than the previous generations were. So let's give them a little bit of love on that. I love to hear that. I agree with you. I see the same thing. It's not every candidate, but the right ones tend to prepare and have way compelling questions to ask us and of the company and have an understanding of why they want this role, much different than I would say 15, 20 years ago. So I think you're spot on there. I'm interested when you're interviewing with candidates, how do you give them an understanding? Like, how do you create an experience where they know what it's like to work for you and work for the company? Like, what do you do in the interview to have to give them a realistic job preview of what they'll be expected if they take the role?
Yeah, I'd key in on the realistic there. I think one of the big things that I like to focus on, one, I'll give a general overview of the company, kind of what we're doing. Hopefully they've already kind of prepared that, but what are the core strategies? But I will spend a good amount of time talking through here's where you're probably going to get frustrated, and here are the biggest challenges. And I don't do that necessarily to scare anybody away, but it's very easy to get enamored and romanticize about the amazing things that the company is doing, and everything is really positive. But a few months in, and you realize that, your work is very ambiguous, your data is fragmented, you can't get the answers that you want, maybe you have some employee churn issues, there's all of those things. And I think you got to know that coming in, make sure that you want to do that. So we spend a lot of time kind of just talking through the challenges, none of them being insurmountable, but I spend probably less time trying to sell on all of the positives than I do in just trying to be as real as possible. Because I mean, I think the main reason people leave, at least within that first year, is it doesn't meet anything that they thought it would when they originally applied.
Yeah, I think the way we look at it is sell them in and then sell them out. So get them understanding why this is a great place to work and why they would want to work here. But as they go through the process and it gets more serious, help them understand it's not all puppy dogs and lollipops here either. This is what you need to understand. And I need you to make a mutual decision here on if this is something that's going to make sense for you, because it's a lot harder on you if you have to leave the job in 6 months to a year because you're not happy than it is in the company. The company typically keeps on moving. You got to go back on that job search. That doesn't look great on a resume. People are always asking questions. Why were you at Lumen for only 6 months? So I think it's very incumbent on leaders to do that and make sure that we're clear about that. And I was listening to a pod today, and I very much believe this. It's the founder of Sastr was saying this, and he was talking about hiring Salesforce for a SaaS company. And he says, when you make a when something doesn't go right with a new hire, it's 100% on you as a hiring manager. Here's why. Either you didn't hire them properly, right? Or you haven't been able to effectively manage them to get what you thought you were getting out of the interview process, right? And I think there's something real to that, because if you're super comprehensive about understanding what the person's motivations are, what the company does well and what it doesn't do well, what they'll have to deal with if we're a big and ambiguous environment versus a very analytical environment versus a fast-paced environment, like understanding who you are as a leader, what your team is and what your company is, and being able to convey that, I just think is so key. But again, I think the bigger responsibility is because the companies just keep moving forward. If it doesn't work out, the individual can be a lot more disastrous. So I think it's really, really important that people take it as seriously as you do. And I appreciate you saying that. You work for a really big company that is very progressive from a technology perspective. So I'm interested to ask, when it comes to hiring technology, like when you're interviewing, like are you writing down on like a piece of paper? Or are you just committing it to memory? Or are you filling things out in a system or in Excel? Like how do you capture information when you're interviewing?
Yeah, I've never been a huge note taker. I've tried so many times, but I end up with the same book for a really long time. But I'll jot little words down here or there, and then usually I'll just reflect after the conversation and just kind of put my thoughts down because I'll move on to the next thing and kind of forget about it. And then we do have some formal things that are really just kind of, I don't know whether they're in Excel or in Word, but it's the same kind of concept that
Is it like
you
a
have to
feedback
fill in,
rubric
like,
or what is it? Like, is it
yeah,
like, okay.
essentially, yeah, like here's the selection form. Here's kind of what I liked, what the drawbacks are. And the other big thing is always try to have a full committee of folks that have talked to this person, whether they speak to a panel or whether they speak to other people, and just get those other perspectives and then get together as a group and kind of talk it through. Because where I have like gone sideways or not hired the right person, it's because I get enamored with a conversation or something like, I like them. They're a really nice person. And we seem to gel really well in the conversation. And I didn't poke at certain things. Other people didn't have other perspectives. And here we are, and I'm looking for another candidate,
It's affirmation bias, right? And sometimes it happens when you look at the resume and you see, oh, they worked at a company I really respect, or they graduated from this school, right? Or it can be, I really enjoyed the conversation, and they think a lot like I do. And then what ends up happening is subliminally, or subconsciously, we are now interviewing them in rather than interviewing them out. And to your point, you start to miss things that they, if you didn't have that affirmation bias, you would dig deeper into and maybe get better answers. And so you are not alone on that. And by the way, the question around the technology is a loaded one too, because everybody I talk to, same thing. There's very few things out there that make this process a better experience for the candidate and the hiring manager and provide more certainty. And so I ask that question a lot of times because I'm trying to hear and get some hope and somebody tell me something they're working with that's really exciting them and changing the game for them. But unfortunately, I haven't had too many people tell me that. So we'll keep working on that and see if we can help transform the industry. Over here at MSH and Aon. All right, I want to jump into a couple other things. So let's talk a little bit about your current work. What are you working on right now that you're excited about that gets you out of bed in the morning? Anything that's, super exciting?
Yeah, it's a little bit unique. I'm kind of bouncing between different projects right now. I focus mainly on the cost side of our business, but we have a lot of really cool new products that are coming out that are really shaping the entire industry, I think, for years to come. But with telecom and the age that our company is, we have a lot of legacy products as well. Old copper stuff, not on fiber. It's old technology. And we have to figure out a way of migrating thousands of customers really off of those older platforms onto a newer platform or some new technology. Because ultimately, as that technology ages, it just gets more and more expensive to try to maintain and terrible customer experience as time goes on, so
Sure.
big part of
I'm a
that.
telecom user, so I can certainly I can certainly agree with
Exactly.
you on that.
Yeah, so it's that's probably the biggest thing I'm focused on right now. It's completely different than things I've done in the past of just helping a sales team, get more productive or sell more easily or cutting cost or something like that. It's kind of trying to put all of that together. How do you get a customer to convert? How do you get the customers off of a certain piece of the network? Where are the best places to focus from a regional perspective throughout the country? What are the savings we're going to get there? And it's working really with our product group, with our sales group, all around the company, which is really fun to kind of have that cross-functional view of things as well.
Love that. That's awesome. I will be keeping tabs on that. Definitely, innovation is an amazing thing, and the way that we interact with our customers in any given company is the way that most technologies are disrupting things. So I think that is, and making it a better experience, making it more streamlined, making it cheaper. Those are all things we all want and need. And so, really, really love to hear that. All right, let's have a little fun here. I usually ask about a book, and you can definitely tell me about a book. But I'm just interested in any content you've consumed recently that you really loved. It could be a TV show, it could be a magazine article, it could be a tweet. What do they call it now? An X post. It could be a book. Is there anything that you've consumed recently that you really enjoyed?
There's probably a couple of things from a book perspective, and this is all on the people side. Brené Brown wrote a book called Dare to Lead, and it's been around for a number of years. Some really good things, I think, in there. We've worked on it with my team, and we've looked through it. The whole company is starting to go through it.
I might have a Brené Brown book back here. I have to look, but yeah,
Yeah,
great, great author.
some really great stuff there. And I think there's also some stuff that's popped up just on LinkedIn recently and about storytelling from like Harvard Business Review, storytelling and having a perspective, which is exactly like what I probably need to get a lot better at is how do I tell the story to get the buy-in? How do I get people more engaged in what I'm trying to put together from a numbers perspective into more of a story format and add a perspective to that? And so it kind of resonates a bit with me in that I think that's just something I probably should continue to evolve along with everybody on my team probably.
Yeah, I want to share one with you because I read the De Facto. Hold on, I read the De Facto book on storytelling. So hold on, real quick. So their story brand, which is amazing, and it talks a little bit about. Yeah, this is what I was looking for. Matthew Dicks. What is the name of his book? Storyworthy. So this book, I was interested in storytelling. I actually had a storytelling consultant I was working with for a little bit. It's become really key to, my ability to, put forth a proposal, to talk to investors, to do the different things. Being able to kind of build that narrative and kind of build that story is really key. And so story brand is really good because it talks about marketing and making your customer the superhero. So that's a book I read a few years ago. Really, really good. But Matthew Dicks has a book called Story Worthy. Incredible book. Super fun read, by the way. Like, it's like really hilarious. He has a bunch of stories in there, but very tactical in terms of how it helps us tell better stories. And he's like a professional storyteller. Like, I guess there's this competition that, he competes in, and he's won, like, it's called the Moth competition or something like that. And he's done really, really amazing stuff with it. So highly recommend that. If you're interested in that, check out
Absolutely.
that book and tell me what you think about it.
Yeah, definitely will do.
I think you're like, all right, so last question for me here. So Kevin, if we had to talk to Kevin from 20 years ago, and give him advice or a career nugget that you didn't know then but that you know now, and you can't say be prepared or prepared for your interview, but what bit of advice would you offer your younger self that you know now that you didn't know then?
I would say be flexible and be adaptable.
Okay.
Look at everything as an experience versus, there's plenty of things out there that, staying with a company that may be just a lateral move, but it's a different experience. And the more adaptable you can be, especially with just things accelerating even more, the more success you'll see and the more vital and relevant you will be to the company or to anybody.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin, I gotta tell you. I think you give great advice. And if anybody should be listened to, it's the guy that has made it work at one company for 20 years across three acquisitions and risen up to the level you have. You obviously have a lot of great philosophy on leadership, talent, and obviously finance. So I'm very appreciative of you coming on. Thanks for taking a little bit of time. And I can't wait to talk our next conversation. Thanks
Thanks for
again.
having me.
Thank you for listening to Higher Learning with me, Oz Rashid. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode.